so I'm just going to say it. You have been lied to. You have a terrible lie from the depths of hell. You think you want to fall in love, waiting for Cupid's arrow to magically strike, and you know the first sight, Prince Charming, White Horse, all of this noise, it is a lie. That ain't love. That's lust. And believe me, ain't nothing wrong with a little lust. Nothing. It's just that lust does not wake up at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday to take care of your kid who just vomited all over the living room carpet. Lust snuck out the back window. But love works. Love knows. Love sees your extra 20 pounds, your unlotioned legs, your first gray hair, your 3,000th gray hair, and love keeps on being love. And here's the awful truth. Even love, true love, it might just have a breaking point. Today in Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, No More Lies. That's a public service announcement. We proudly present Joy and Pain. Amazing stories from real people doing their damnedest just to keep it together. My name is Glenn Washington. Hold someone close, or hold someone else close. Life is short. Your choice. Because this is Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Now then, some couples are not like the rest of us. There's this air of destiny, of purpose, of direction to their relationship, to the point where the rest of us kind of feed off their relationship. You know who I'm talking about. Snap Judgment.
When I think about the relationships I've been in, it seems like 50 to 80% of the time has always been spent trying to break up. It's like the first time I call someone my boyfriend is just the beginning of goodbye. And I'm not the only one. I look around at my friends and I see long, drawn-out breakups. Of all the people I know around my age, there's one couple I can picture still fiercely in love 40 years down the line. One couple. My old roommate, Claire, and her boyfriend, Finbloom. Finbloom and Claire told me they want to get married someday, and that I'd get the enormous honor of officiating their wedding. I can remember so clearly when they first met.
I remember in the beginning, like, I thought that he was a lot older.
We had really animalistic physical chemistry.
You could see his body hair, like, coming out at the edges of his shirt. He kind of seemed like an animal.
When you just are coming into that with someone, it's like pretty intense.
Claire met Aaron Finbloom in a coffee shop in Brooklyn. Finbloom, by the way, is called Finbloom because the name Aaron sounds so tame. And Finbloom is a very eccentric man. That's what Claire loved about him.
Our first date was when we went to see the Neo-Futurists. They do like 20 plays in an hour. And I was really struck by the way that Aaron was like talking to strangers the entire time. Being around Finbloom, it's like having a magnet. I guess because he wears his eccentricity on his sleeve or his forehead, or it draws other people toward him.
On that first date, Claire and Finbloom were so excited by each other, they literally skipped through the streets. Finbloom used to carry around an accordion, and he would serenade Claire outside her window at night. Claire once wrote a poem and left it for Finbloom in his bedroom. And I don't mean a little note on the pillow. The poem, conceived on sticky notes, covered the surface of his desk, traveled down across the floor, and then up along his bookshelf and walls. It spanned the entirety of his room. Finbloom says it was one of the best presents he ever got.
Hello, this is Sharon. Leave a message.
Hey, Sherman, Claire. Finbloom and I want to ask you something that no one has ever asked you before, and no one will ever ask you again. So just give me a call back whenever, and I look forward to talking to you.
I'd been out of town for a while, and rumor had it Finbloom and Claire were going polyamorous. So the message could have only meant one thing. Did I want to have a threesome? Suffice it to say, I didn't call them back for a while. Then I get this email in my inbox from Finbloom. Here's Finbloom.
Dear friend, we, Clarence Steinbloom, broke up on the 1st of October, and we feel we must honor the death of our relationship by laying it to rest in the earth in the presence of its most dearly beloved.
They broke up. My favorite couple. No longer a couple. It's embarrassing to admit this, but I was devastated. So, okay, back to that mysterious phone message. The question no one had ever asked me and no one would ever ask me again. Would I officiate the funeral of their relationship, their unwedding?
In accordance with Jewish tradition, we hope to have the funeral as soon as possible. And so it is with great love, endearment, and gratitude that we invite you to our unwedding. Dress is formal, expressive, symbolic. Much love, Aaron Finbloom and Claire Epstein.
Claire and Finbloom did, in fact, have 3 very happy years in a solid relationship. But then that thing happened that happens in all of our relationships. What Claire fell in love with turned stale. Finbloom's eccentricity stopped being thrilling to her and instead became embarrassing. For example, when Finbloom and Claire went out one Halloween, Claire was confronted with a few difficult facts. 1, Finbloom was completely naked. 2, he was draped head to toe in rotting, raw fish. All Halloween night, when Finbloom would walk down the street, others would have to cross the street. The stench was so severe. When Claire first told the story of this Halloween, she was all giggles and, "Isn't Finbloom great?" But the longer they were together, and the more times Claire told the story, the more she seemed bothered by it. And at a certain point, Claire simply did not want to be the person standing next to the naked man wearing rotting, raw fish.
Dearly beloved, thanks for coming to Finbloom and Claire's unwedding. We are here because the 2 people standing before you have dared to reimagine breaking up.
From the first moment, the unwedding had lots of correlations with an actual wedding. Finbloom's best friend Abe flew in from Minneapolis to perform as best man. Our friend Richard, who photographs weddings professionally, was there taking pictures. I wore a long black velvet gown. I was heartbroken that my friends were breaking up. But as 2 of the world's best weirdos, at least they were doing it in a weirdo way. Standing at the gates of Prospect Park in Brooklyn, for the 12 or so guests and myself, whatever skepticism we may have had seemed to fade away when we saw the unbride.
I hadn't seen her in like 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, she looked really beautiful, as I usually think she does when I see her.
The leaves were like bright yellow. It was so beautiful. You know, the height of autumn. Yeah, I was really happy that day just because I felt like all my friends were like coming together. I felt really excited about the next chapter of my life and also felt really grateful to Finbloom for working through this with me. But then seeing Finbloom was like this reminder of like, oh my God, this is so profoundly painful. And I think he still kind of didn't understand in some ways.
For the ceremony, Finbloom and Claire designed rituals for themselves. It was sort of like writing your own vows, only writing them completely for yourself. Finbloom's ritual was to purge himself of all the sweet nothings Claire had ever texted him.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you to approach Finbloom one by one and whisper your message into his ear.
He typed them all out, he printed them, and then he deleted them from his computer and phone.
And I ask that as you deliver the message...
The hardest part for me was, well, I think the one I did the most crying was probably during when the text messages were read. Everyone took turns kneeling down on the ground, whispering the text messages into my ear.
I guess the ones that were either funny or sweet, and I kind of didn't realize until the last minute, erotic.
Excuse me? No, read all the messages that you have.
I love it when you get out of the shower and your towel falls, and you see me watching you.
I love you.
I always want to be watching you.
There were some that I cried and some that I laughed. After they were all read to me, we put them in a little chalice and burned them. And then I played a little short song on the harmonica.
There'd be no record of their existence after that, except I guess, in the collective memory of the people who came to the unwedding.
Finbloom and Claire will miss spooning each other's bodies. Claire will miss how everything she ever did with Finbloom had a heightened sense of meaning. Finbloom will miss how yes-saying Claire is and how affirmative it is to be around her. Finbloom will miss Claire's smell. Finn, please lean into dear Claire and take a whiff.
At that point in the ceremony, Finbloom leaned into Claire. I looked around and most of the guests were crying. And I was crying too. It was as if we were all mourning breakups from our own lives, or were getting to say goodbye to the ghosts of relationships past. The ceremony ended with Claire and Finbloom walking out of the park, alone, in separate directions. And there was this distinct question or feeling in the air that hung over everything. The event seemed so right. If they could do something like this together, with such togetherness, why were they breaking up?
Oh yeah, a lot of people said that to me when I told them about what we were doing. They were like, you guys are doing this amazing thing. You guys can't break up. they'd said almost exactly that.
Okay, so it's 3 months later. I sat down with Finbloom and Claire to see how everything was going.
So what's going on now? What's the state of you and Claire?
Things are indeterminate a little bit.
Oh, it's so confusing. Obviously I remember feeling like this is so over. Us being in a relationship is... it's not a reality, I can continue with. I'll just say that, in the time since the unwedding, Finbloom has just really been great.
We have hooked up a little bit. Did you want me to give a different version of the story?
No. I want the truth, but I want to also express that as the officiator, I suppose if you had gotten married, if I were the officiator of your wedding and then you got a divorce, I would have been pissed.
Yeah.
As the officiator of your unwedding funeral, it is a little bit annoying to me that it was just a fun thing that didn't really count.
I understand you being annoyed. I think you should be annoyed. But at the time, it felt absolutely real, necessary, eternal, and very meaningful and serious.
In some ways, I feel like the unwedding purged out a lot of the negativity and replaced it with something positive, which paradoxically makes me look back and then question everything.
Claire and Finbloom thought the unwedding would make their breakup less painful or less lonely, less ugly. But they rekindled their feelings and fell back into breakup purgatory. And that way, they're back where everyone else seems to be. Stuck. Trying to break up.
I don't want to get over you.
Bad news. So sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but I gotta let you know that Finbloom and Claire officially broke up. But you know what? They officially broke up before, so I don't know. Let's just thank them for sharing their story. Maybe we'll see them back here next year. That piece was produced by Sharon Mashihi and Rachel James. It was adapted for Snap by Julie DeWitt. It originally came from KCRW's wonderful, unfictional show. We're going to have a link to their program on our website, snapjudgment.org. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Joy and Pain episode. Stay tuned. I didn't even know it was Valentine's Day until my then girlfriend handed me my Valentine's gift. And then she's waiting, what'd you get from me? You can't fool a smart woman. Don't make the mistake I did. Order Shari's Berries today for guaranteed gift satisfaction. These giant, freshly dipped strawberries from Shari's Berries, starting at $19.99 and over 40% savings, or double the berries when you order just $10 more. You just need my code BEAT when you order. They're dipped in white milk and dark chocolatey goodness, topped with chocolate chips, with decorative swizzle or nuts. 40% off from Shari's Berries. Enormous, romantic, fresh, juicy, mouthwatering. I just got my box of hand-picked chocolate dip, gift wrap, climate sealed, delicious berry goodness. Lord, it's got the dark chocolate. It's got the light chocolate. However you like your chocolate, if you know what I mean. It's all up in there. Here's the only way to get this amazing Valentine's Day deal. Giant, freshly dipped strawberries starting at $19.99 or double the berries for just $10 more. Visit BERRIES.com. Click on the microphone in the top right corner and type in BEAT. Go to berries.com, click on the microphone and type in BEAT. Order today before they sell out.
Thanks for listening to Snap Judgment. Help shape the future of Snap and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
Welcome back to the Snap. Now, today, our next couple, Henry and Jane, they know a little something about the struggle. Snap favorite, Leah Tao, has the story.
This is Jane Evans. She and her husband Henry have been married 26 years. They have 4 kids, and they used to have the kind of marriage where he was a CFO and she was a stay-at-home mom. And this took a toll in the typical ways.
We had 2 different worlds. He would come home. And there would be toys all over the floor because we were playing games or whatever. And then he would come in and say, "How can you stand this?" And I was like, "All right, hang on here, pal. You're walking through the door and just seeing this."
This used to be their biggest issue. Now they have a different kind of problem.
Henry, I'm going to move your legs this way. I'm going to rock you a little bit, okay? 1, 2, 3. Okay, ready, Henry? Here we go. Scoot him in here. That's it.
That's Jane transferring Henry from his bed to his wheelchair. 11 years ago, he suffered a brainstem stroke, which left him paralyzed and mute. He could blink with one eye. That was the only movement he had left. Their kids were 6, 8, 12, and 13. And the doctors told Jane she had to put Henry in a facility, that there was no way she could care for him at home. She disagreed. Jane is tiny. She's 5'2". Henry is 6'4", and almost double her weight, but she moves him by herself twice a day.
Well, you know what? The first time I brought him home, I dropped him. And thank God, the therapist showed me what to do if you drop somebody. You fall with them. You don't just drop them like a hot potato.
At the time of the stroke, Henry was your all-American businessman and dad. Tall, handsome, do-it-yourself kind of guy with a fast-paced Silicon Valley job. He was 40 years old when he suddenly became trapped in his body. He had what's called locked-in syndrome, meaning his mental capacities were fully intact, but he lost all movement and speech, and his only way to communicate was through eye blinks, going through the entire alphabet.
He got to the point where he was begging me to kill him. Beg me, just beg me to shoot him in the backyard.
Jane's life was also turned upside down.
Taking care of Henry, being by his side, going to all his therapy, it's like I've lived this nightmare as the caregiver, but as a wife. And you are exhausted. Tell me what you need, Henry. Do you want your head back? No. I could put him in a nursing home or put him in a corner, but that's not how I would want to be treated.
The kids had to help out, too.
We were helping him go to the bathroom one night. We had him on the toilet, and I said, Stephen, I need you to bend down and just make sure that he's perfectly aligned with that toilet. And I was dealing with a spasm or something, so that's why I couldn't do it.
Stephen is the oldest kid. He was 13 at the time.
He looked at me and said, you want me to look at my dad's butt? And I said, Stephen, we'll be on that point right now. Just tell me that he's aimed right and let's just go. I was just on overdrive. He bends down and you can see his face get all red. And Henry's kind of tense sitting there too. And Stephen says, geez, Dad, never thought we'd be cheek to cheek like this. And Henry started laughing. Stephen started laughing. And it broke up that awkward moment.
Slowly, Henry began to regain some control of his body.
In the beginning, he literally was like a Raggedy Ann doll. He couldn't even sit in a wheelchair. But I'll tell you the big marker with him improving. A James Bond movie came out about that time. Halle Berry was in it. And he wanted to go see that movie so badly. I mean, Halle Berry should know the effect that she had on this man. And they said you are not allowed to go to a movie unless you can sit in a chair for 4 hours.
So good.
So he worked and worked and worked on it.
Especially when you're bad.
He went to the movie. I mean, he did it.
Another big breakthrough came when they started using a letter board to communicate.
M, U, much, B, much, B-I, G, bigger.
This is Jane doing the letter board with Henry. He wanted me to know how extraordinary it is that Jane is able to move him.
M, E, N, much bigger men, C, A, N, can't, D, do, that.
The board is a plexiglass square with the letters in groups. A, B, C is one group, and so on. Henry looks at a group of letters, which Jane reads to him, and when she gets to the right letter, he nods, because he's also learned to nod again. This is much faster, of course, than going through the entire alphabet for each letter, especially because Jane is very good at filling in the blanks. Most of the time, she can guess a word from just a few letters.
Board again? I, A, M, A, M, amazed. After almost 10 years, you're still amazed?
What's even more amazing is that they can do the letter board without the actual board. One day, they'd accidentally left it at home, and they discovered that they can do what they call virtual board.
Now, virtual board, what happens is this letter board becomes impregnated into your brain. You just see it. Or I watch his eyes in the air, and I know the group of letters that he's looking at.
A combination of ingenuity and the ability to laugh in the face of tragedy seems to have helped this family. And for all the things Henry lost, he always had laughter. This could actually be a problem at times, especially in the early days after the stroke when the emotional centers of his brain were heavily affected.
T, E, tell, Leia, about, S, T, A, R. Oh gosh, Henry, this was terrible. We were at a talent show, and this little girl gets up, and she could not sing, okay? He lost it. I mean, he was laughing. He was crying. He was laughing so hard. The whole audience turned to us. I mean, this poor girl was supposed to be the show. Okay, Henry was the show. I even put the towel in his mouth for him to bite down. I'm wheeling him out of the theater as fast as I could run with him. And I mean, unless you understand the stroke victim, it was so cruel what happened. But it's like, you can't fake it, okay?
A few years ago, Henry got a program to help him speak through a computer, and he sometimes chimes in with a robotic voice, but it's still much faster for him to do the letter board with Jane. He's also been doing speech therapy to try to learn to actually speak again, but it's not easy.
We were in the van, and he broke down crying because he was trying to mouth, I love you, and it didn't sound like it. I knew what he was saying, but he got so overwhelmed with emotion and frustrated. Then he asked for the board and said, I can't even tell my wife I love her. And I said, you just did. And I would start crying.
We are basically one person. We just can't decide if we are a boy or a girl.
Despite how fused they seem at times, Henry has a private inner world where he gets totally lost.
Henry, there are times when you literally don't hear me. I would go mad if I did not daydream. Mm-hmm. And so he and I are 20 in this world. you run in this world, right? Yeah.
He's daydreaming of you two together at 20. That's kind of neat.
Well, that's what he says anyway. I don't know if Halle Berry's in that one. G-H-I-A-M-N-O. I am not S-T-U. I'm not stupid, he says.
Henry and Jane seem able to laugh about anything. And it was almost hard to believe that they could be so cheerful. I wanted to talk to each of them alone to see what they might reveal about their inner sorrows and woes. Of course, talking to Henry alone is a challenge because he can't talk. But he's regained movement in two fingers, which allows him to type. So we corresponded on email, and he sent me this, which took him half a day to write. Days took forever in the beginning. I just focused on the second hand, and each minute was a lifetime. I was painfully bored. This only went away with time, months and years. Now, when I count my blessings, lovely family, beautiful view, the fact that I'm alive and surrounded by friends, I'm happy. When I focus too much on what was or what could have been, I'm sad. Jane is amazing. She's the true hero of this story. Has there ever been a moment where you thought, can't do it?
Absolutely. I'd be lying here to you if I told you that it was all a piece of cake and everything. No, are you kidding me? But you know what? I had a friend say to me the other day, you and your husband talk more than most people I know that can talk because you have all the time in the world. That's the one thing Henry has. Henry has time.
And time is the one thing they never had before the stroke, when they were in their separate worlds with their separate stresses and neither had the energy to hear the complaints of the other.
I wanted him to listen to the frustrations I had during the day, and he didn't want to hear about it because his job was so fast-paced. And I didn't learn this until after the stroke and we were going through our entire marriage. And I said, oh my gosh, Henry, I looked at you as so self-centered because I was so ignorant to his world. Yeah, and so it definitely has brought us closer, definitely. Not to say it was all rosy, no. Could I do this for just anybody? No, couldn't pay me to do this job. Could I do it for him? Absolutely. But I look back when the kids were so little, and I actually ask myself, how did I do it? I don't know, but that's what marriage is about.
But if you're exhausted, like you need a hug, he can't even give you a hug, right?
Yes,
I mean,
he can.
That he can?
Yes, he can. I can place his arms around me and then he can pull in a little bit. It's actually a really, really special hug because you feel it coming from the heart.
How often do you do that?
Not often enough. But no, I have to say last night I did that.
Wow. Big love to Henry and Jane Evans. That story, it came to us from the amazing Leia Tao. Check out a link to her podcast, the wonderful podcast Strangers, at kcrw.com/strangers, and we'll link to it on our website, snapjudgment.org. Our next guest had to make it work for one of the most difficult places there is, solitary confinement. Snap Judgment.
I was the only woman with a sentence of death in the United States at that time. But there was no really death row for women at that time. So I was kept in solitary confinement in complete isolation.
When she was 26 years old, Sunny Jacobs and her husband Jesse Tefero caught a ride with a friend down a dark Florida highway. They pulled over on the roadside for a rest when they were approached by the police. There's conflicting accounts about what happened next. What is known is that there was a shootout that ended with two dead officers. Both Sunny and her husband Jesse said they were innocent and that the driver of the car actually killed the officers. But when the dust settled, the driver was sentenced to life. Sunny and Jesse were sentenced to death and sent away to separate prisons.
Every day, during count time, You'd have to sit on your bed and be quiet, no talking, and they would come around and count everybody in the prison. And we used that time because they do it at the same time in all the prisons in Florida. So we would use that time for meditation. And we would both meditate and sort of send our spirits out there and be together. That was, for us, a sort of a more intimate joining than you could have if you were physically together. After a while, they allowed us to write letters. We wrote every day. We would try to keep each other's spirits up. That went on for the entire 15 years.
The night her husband Jesse was set to be executed, prison officials allowed them to talk on the phone.
They gave us 10 minutes. And at the end, we just kept saying, I love you. We never actually said goodbye. We just kept saying, I love you. And then finally, he said, they're giving me the finger across the throat sign, which meant to hang up. And that was it. That was the end. And I just put my head down on the desk and cried. That was the love of my life, and that was it. You only get one of those. And so, when he was executed, it was as if he was still with me, because I wasn't used to his physical presence anymore for many years. And yet we were closer than probably people who lived together in the same house, because we had a sort of a spiritual daily life together. So, for me, he wasn't really gone. He was still there with me.
Sunny, while fighting her own conviction, spent years waiting alone in solitary confinement for her own execution.
For a long time, I just couldn't imagine that they would really kill me. But I did think, if they ever came to, you know, to take me, to execute me, what would I do? And I thought, well, I'll fight them, you know. You wouldn't let them just take you and execute you. But once you get to that point where there's nowhere to go, where you're a prisoner and there's nowhere to run, there's no help coming, I think it becomes more important to have some sort of dignity.
After 17 years in prison, Sunny's case was overturned on appeal. A key witness in the case admitted that she had lied on the stand about Sunny's guilt. And the driver of the car that deadly night had eventually confessed to killing the two officers himself. So Sunny was released. But she still carried Jesse around with her.
I always maintained this sort of bubble in which Jesse and I had a life together. Even when I was released from prison, it was as if he was still there with me, like we inhabited one body. That's the only thing that changed, was we only had one body instead of two. And it actually came to a point where I had to have a little conversation with Jesse the spirit and say, listen, there's going to come a time, I think, when we might not be able to both inhabit this body. So once you're out in the world again, the possibilities open up that weren't open before.
Friends introduced Sunny to new people. She reunited with her children. And there was always this one guy that everyone talked to her about. His name was Peter Pringle. He lived in Ireland. And eventually, she got in touch with him. She was actually going to go to Ireland for a trip. She knew nothing about this Peter Pringle, but when she got there, they met up.
I mean, I don't even know this person, and I'm in a different continent where I don't know anyone at all. Peter was a complete gentleman.
Yeah, well, I instinctively liked her. She's a very bubbly personality, and she has a beautiful smile. She's a tiny little woman, mind you, compared to me.
Here's this big,
Irish man who looks like a fisherman. He looks like the man on the cough drops. I really wasn't sure that we'd have anything particularly in common.
Peter drove her on a sightseeing trip through Ireland. And in the car, she told him the story of her time in prison, of losing Jesse and of her case being overturned. And he seemed more interested, more moved than other people she had told.
When we were crossing on the car ferry across the River Shannon, and we were eating our packed lunch, and she turned to me and said to me, like, well, what's your interest in all of this? And I said, well, I too was sentenced to death, and I did 15 years.
Peter explained that in 1980, he had been convicted for the murder of two police officers. He had been sentenced to death by hanging. He fought his case throughout his imprisonment, insisting he was the wrong guy. And in 1992, he reopened his case. He eventually proved his innocence and was set free.
For the first time, I was 3 years out of prison at that stage. And for the first time since I came out of prison, I was able to speak with somebody who totally understood where I had come from. We were driving along the road and talking about our mutual experiences. And at times we would be laughing, and at times we were crying.
It was so surreal. It was as if I'd reached the end of the rainbow. Because here we were, happily driving along in the most beautiful place I'd ever seen, talking about having been sentenced to death and being in prison and all these, and it was in the midst of all this beauty.
But I hadn't thought in terms of having a relationship with her at that stage, because, you know, I was uncertain about having relationships with people.
I, too, wasn't sure if I could ever really have a relationship again.
Just because they had both had similar traumatic life experiences, that didn't mean everything would fall into place. Actually, it meant having a relationship might be pretty tough.
Having been isolated for so long and having to sort of curtail those emotions for so many years, I wasn't really sure if I could live with anyone else again.
When I was released from the Special Criminal Court in Dublin, the tendency I had was to withdraw within myself. And I actually went and rented a cottage in the country because I couldn't be with too many people at the time.
Plus, they lived on different continents. And having lost over a decade of their lives in prison, neither Sonny nor Peter had a career or any job skills or any money. Still, they were pulled to each other in a way they couldn't ignore.
Our compatibility is not just the fact that both of us were sentenced to death.
There was more to this than just two people who had shared a common history of injustice. I knew there was something special. It was like the bells were going off in my head.
So Sonny moved to Ireland, and they tried to make a go of it.
We've no money, of course, and we've no prospects of money. But we rented a cottage, and we have two cats and three dogs, four hens and five goats, all of whom are rescue animals, the same as ourselves.
One day, we took our two dogs down to the sea, and we exchanged rings
On the shortest day of the year, on the winter solstice, we decided we exchanged rings in the morning to get engaged, and in the evening we went down to the sea, and we exchanged vows. And we were married.
And now, these days, Peter and I, every day, spend at least 20 minutes meditating together. Except now we can do it side by side.
Big thanks to Sonny and Peter for sharing their story. Check out our website, snapjudgment.org, for more information on the amazing work they're doing right now. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman. Now, when Snap returns, we're going to show you how play is play. When Snap Judgment, the Joy and Pain episode continues. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap Judgment. Now it's time for us to listen to you. Voice your opinions and provide feedback about public radio at nprlistens.org. Your input helps NPR's efforts to bring you the news and stories that matter. Have a say at nprlistens.org.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the Joy and Pain episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and I think it's funny that when you turn on the TV looking for a love story, they always want to have some super young people moaning and weeping about whatever problem they got themselves into that week. But if you really want to know about love, Snappers, you got to talk to the elders. Snap Judgment's Julia DeWitt brings us this story all the way from the Southern Hemisphere.
Meet Frank and Wilma.
You start.
Well, me start?
Yeah.
I'm not the most important
okay.
person.
My you name start. Is Frank.
And we live in New Zealand. My name is Wilma. I'm his wife. We are 46 years married.
They live in New Zealand, but they're originally from Austria. And they're getting on in years, so Frank's hearing isn't great. Wilma often talks for him.
I'm his translator.
A few years ago, before their life together was turned on its head, Frank and Wilma had a big house, kids, grandkids. Frank owned his own company.
A nice garden, swimming pool. We had a good lifestyle here in New Zealand.
But then, on one otherwise totally regular morning,
Frank was eating bacon and eggs, and it hit his gallstones. And he had such a pain, so I had to bring him to the doctor.
When Frank went to the doctor, the x-rays also turned up something else. Frank had lung cancer. Was actually kind of lucky because they caught it early and they could jump on it quickly. It looked like the cancer went away.
But 2 years later, I was chopping firewood and suddenly I couldn't breathe anymore. So they brought me to the hospital, did a scan and an x-ray. Then he told us I got another cancer on the sake of my heart and I have 3 months to live.
They asked the doctor if there was anything they could do, but it was too late for treatment. Frank was terminal.
Was like somebody a kick in the stomach, you know?
In that moment, their future together evaporated. Still, and you can feel it right away when you talk to them, they're matter-of-fact kind of people. Definitely not the type to wallow. You pull yourself up, you fix things. Nothing is the end of the world. Except now, it kind of was. And they weren't sure what to do about that.
My GP asked me if I'm depressed, if I need any depression tablets or something, you know. I mean, it wouldn't help, wouldn't make any difference, you know. I mean, I wasn't depressed. I was just pretty confused, let's put it this way, you know.
Maybe you were depressed, but, you know, depression
maybe,
doesn't exist for
no,
us.
It was quite a confusing situation.
Suddenly, what seemed so important the day before, it didn't matter anymore.
I didn't have anything to lose. I mean, yeah, I mean, if they tell you you got 3 months to live, what do you have to lose now?
He is giving away all his things because he said, well, I don't need a quad bike, I don't need a fishing gear, I don't need my tools, I don't even need my clothes because I'm going to die anyway.
Of course, Wilma was not going to die. But when people asked her about her plans for after Frank was gone,
I didn't know. I really didn't know. I said, well, I'll make a decision when the time comes. For me, the only thing was important that Frank had the rest of his life a good life. You know, I cooked everything he really liked, which I shouldn't have because he put weight on. He got up to 100 kilo. I nearly killed him with the weight. And there was nothing which I actually denied for him. Whatever he wanted to do, we did. So I said to my husband, okay, what do you want to do?
Well, I said I would like to have one nice holiday together with you because we're living 45 years together. I said, I want to go on holiday with you.
Frank and Wilma packed their bathing suits and hopped a plane for Fiji for a 6-week tropical vacation. If you have 3 months to live, well, you splurge.
We went in a special resort.
One of the expensive places.
I tell you one thing, you would not believe how fast it goes. Where I paid $24,000. I never would have done this in my life.
$24,000 is a lot of money for Frank and Wilma. What little reserves they had left after doctor's bills, they were burning through it.
It was like a honeymoon again, huh?
Yeah, it was like a honeymoon.
He could go deep sea fishing, you know, that comes on top. That's not included in the package. And I said, well, why shouldn't he have it? You know, it's his aim. So do whatever you want to do. And he was lucky. He catched some nice fish, which satisfied him because my husband likes to fish.
Fishing, yeah. And lying on the pool side, hanging around in the pool, yeah.
But in the midst of it all, Frank and Wilma never could totally forget that time was running out.
He had a couple of bad days, and I thought, okay, that's how it starts. That's how it is.
Then after their vacation together, Wilma and Frank went to do the last thing left that Frank wanted to do before he died. They went to go see their grandkids.
The younger one said when we left, she said to her grandfather, she said, you know, she said, Opa, I tell you something. You're not going to die on me because I want to come on holiday in Christmas time on your place. You know, and that was a bit hard because this time we thought, well, okay, there's no Christmas anymore, you know.
I tried to make it pretty fast. I said goodbye, you know, to make it fast. You know, just
you know, don't make it too hard for the kids.
Yeah.
And when we came home after about 6 weeks, we were waiting for him to die. And we were waiting and waiting.
You know, the problem was always thinking, when does it start? Do I wake up tomorrow with pain? I can take a bit of pain, you know. I'm not not one of the guys who can take pain, you know. But the waiting time, that was the worst part of it.
I was waiting for every breath he did. If he stopped breathing, because sometimes, because of the lung operation, he stops for a couple of seconds, I woke up. So I touched him. And then he made some move and I said, okay, it's not happening. Every day, is it happening tomorrow? Is it happening tonight? Until how I said, after 2 years, I had enough. I said, something is definitely wrong. I want somebody to look at this because I cannot go on living like this. Is he going to die or is he not going to die?
Wilma rang the hospital and they sent someone over to see why Frank wasn't dying.
And he said, you good. And we said, what do you mean you're good? He said, no, didn't they tell you? You haven't got any cancer. And I said, you're joking. He said, no. I rang the lung specialist. I said, okay, I want to talk to him. He got us an appointment for the next day. And when we came there, he did another heart echo.
Our X-ray.
And he said, no, he said, that was a wrong diagnosis. You're not having any cancer on the heart. And we could go home.
And my wife went berserk and she said, okay, I want all the statements, whatever from day one when my husband was diagnosed with cancer.
Well, I stood up and left. I had to go because otherwise I would have done something which I most probably ended up in jail. I did not even say goodbye. I just had to go out. And Frank went with me.
I feel relieved, of course, you know, but...
I feel relieved too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't forgive him for the 2 years.
Yeah, it was 2 years of hell.
And you know what the worst thing was? He stopped smoking when he had the lung operation. When the doctor said he has 3 months to live, he started freaking smoking again. And I hate this, you know?
That's the only hope I have, you know?
He said smoking is his only hobby he has. It's a stupid hobby, but okay, he can have it. Yeah, now I should actually charge the doctor for the wrong diagnosis for that he started smoking again. You know, it cost me again a fortune.
Frank and Wilma were ecstatic that Frank was going to live, but now they had to face another harsh reality. After that lavish vacation, they were broke. And now that Frank was going to live, everyone had an opinion about how Frank had gone about dying.
A lot of people said, why did they do it? They said we are idiots because we spent all the money, but well, maybe we were wrong.
Oh,
you know?
No, we are right, Frank. Look at us. We are both happy.
On the other hand, you know, well, we did it this way, you know, and okay, we can change it anyway.
You know, and it was our decision, and that's it.
Now, I think life is more important than money, yeah? It is more important.
Yeah, life is definitely
money
more
is
important.
Good if you have it, you
money,
know.
Exactly.
It's good if you have it.
Because
enough.
You can do certain things which you can't do without money.
Yeah.
But even though they live in a much smaller house now and they're still in debt, that time when they thought Frank was going to die, it was also kind of a refresh button for their lives.
We know we might have, if we're lucky, we might have in a couple of years together, you know, so.
And we enjoy each other. You know, we have enough money to eat. And, well, we don't have any money to go on holiday, but we don't need a holiday, really. That's good enough for us, you know? If we can stay like this for another 10 years, we are happy.
The relationship started brand new. We started a brand new life, more or less.
Yeah, we said we'll go for another 45 years.
Yeah.
Big love to Frank and Wilma. But Frank, for the love of God, lay off the smokes, man. He ain't gonna listen. That piece was produced by Julia DeWitt. You've reached the end of the episode, but not the end of the relationship. The snap will always be true. Get the Snap Judgment special hookup on Facebook. My Twitter handle is Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and those in love with the idea of love. Mark Listich, Pat and Stevie Miller, Anna Sussman, Stephanie Fu, Julia DeWitt, Lenzo Gorio, Jasmine Aguilera, and Will Urbina. Now, could you go over to your lover's place only to discover another car in the driveway? Who is that? Rest assured, it's not the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but much love to the CPB, PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. WBEZ in Chicago is the radio station for lovers. You may have observed that this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could fall in love with that beautiful woman at the coffee shop and then work to get her fired so you could meet her somewhere respectable instead. But when you tell the manager that she gave you a soy latte Americano instead of a soy latte espresso Americano, he could tell you, I'm going to need for you to stop hassling my girlfriend. It'd be okay if you found another coffee shop and everything. And still, you would not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is